We'll now allow Mr. Thomas 10 minutes for the first of the refutations.
Of course, I'm grateful to the senator for his kind words. I have lived long enough to be afraid of being killed by kindness at times. I do not expect it tonight. I also feel very kindly to the senator because I thought and still think that he is one Republican who says what he believes and has a program. But I haven't found that explained tonight. I don't know why you're clapping, but that's your privilege, him or me. But anyway, here's my point. I hoped even in 20 minutes to get a little more clarity than we have got as to where the senator, with his theory, stands on specific acts of legislation. Where he stands on specific matters of foreign policy. It's all very well to say that human nature is the overpowering fact in life, but human nature adapts itself to different conditions which men have made. We help to make the conditions which we reflect ourselves. And I don't think the senator really means that there had been no change in 10,000 years and that our problems in government and in liberty are the same as under the pharaohs. The senator has repeated his opposition to centralism. I also am opposed to totalitarian states. By the way, let me interrupt myself. There's no time to go into it altogether, but of course the communist and socialist idea of socialism is different. Lenin said that socialism would come when the workers got the full product of their toil, and that communism would come when the state would wither away, the same as the senator wants, when the state would wither away, and men would be rewarded according to their need and contribute according to their deed. A noble aspiration not fulfilled. And when the Russians say they've got socialism, they certainly haven't got a society where the workers get the full product of their toil. Now, I'm not going into that any further except to say that I'm not a member of the Socialist Labor Party any more than Senator Goldwater is a member of all the societies that now flourish in Arizona to keep us safe by not thinking at all on anything. But I want to go a little deeper into this question because I know it does concern Senator Goldwater also. I believe I have no desire to destroy the states. Of course not. I wish state lines conformed better to economic realities in the United States. For instance, the state lines are an awful nuisance in dealing with the metropolitan area around New York or other cities. This we have to do the best we can with. But I want to challenge this whole notion that central government is always worse per se than more decentralized government. I want the maximum possible decentralization. I'm like Jefferson in that, and Jefferson wasn't such a decentralist when he took power. Well, that's another question we'll argue with the Democrats. But in any case, oh, by the way, one of the things I'd like to point out, Senator, in your talk about in the past is this. One of the curiosities of American politics is that insofar as there is any consistency, the Democrats are now Federalists and you Republicans are anti-Federalists. And you both say you're inheriting the past. It just shows, well, never mind what it shows. My point is that it's a matter of cold fact that every reform that I have been interested in, and that goes back a lot of words, of years, has had to be furthered by action, federal action. I do not mean that in every case the federal government has adopted a law. For instance, the states did begin to deal with lynching, but not until there was a mighty federal drive for anti-lynching legislation. Freedom in localities? No, not always. There is no freedom when the locality is governed by a completely bigoted majority. And American citizens are entitled to some other protections than local bigotry will give them in many a region. And this is what I want to insist. I repeat, in every case, we have had to look first to federal agitation, partly because of the importance that the average voter puts on the office of president and on Congress and the rest. None of these reforms, which I understood the senator to say that he accepts, how gracefully I don't know, The chief difference between Republicans and Democrats in the last 20, 30 years has been that the Democrats have accepted rather gracefully ideas first called socialistic, and the Republicans have accepted them very much more reluctantly. Well, in this case, though, what I want to point out is that it was necessary that the federal government act. I do not think that the Depression of 32 would have been ended by natural action. I think that you would have faced a terrific rise of an American fascism of the Huey Long, Father Coughlin type, or even of communism, if Roosevelt hadn't done at least as much as he'd done. I believe that many and many a nation, Latin America for instance, will have the Castro-type revolution unless very quickly the ruling class there lets go of some of its power, some of its profits, some of its greed, some of its land, and has a decent system of taxation. This is a necessity, I think, in international affairs. That is to say, something that could be called a turn toward a little less socialism in order to do what they can't do as we managed affairs in the 19th century, and we didn't do it as well as we ought. This is the thing I am saying. Where do you stand, Senator, on some of these things that I've tried to say tell you quite frankly what was the socialist position? It's the interpretation of these fine words. Take the words, sentences by themselves, I would agree in a great many cases, just as he would agree in a great many cases with what I have said. But what about that income tax? Are the people that I have been meeting all over the country who look to a return to paradise of William McKinley because you're a likely candidate for president, they hope, and I would be very pleased. I think we might have a better campaign than we usually have. Well, in any case, I wouldn't vote for you. I have to tell you that. I just like to know where the senator really stands on it. Oh, now of course there are ways in which you can find out amplifications of what I say. Even later than that book, which I'm glad the senator has read, I recommend it still. But we've got socialist platforms more recent. I have written on other of the problems more recently. We have got out, we socialists, a very long and careful report on the baneful influence of these societies, not just the John Birch Society, the whole lot of them. We are criticizing the government for allowing generals not to have facts presented, but to force their interpretation directly or through propagandists of their choice on captive audiences. This is what we object to. We have got out the report that will be issued in a pamphlet. We call for action. We have been told that this is a great centralized government and we don't reckon on men. We do reckon on men. The thing that made me a socialist most of all was living in a district where I saw what poverty and what this thing called capitalism was doing to a great many people. Oh, it had its place in history. Yes, I know it has. And it has proved somewhat reformable. But I have never known capitalism in America or anywhere else to initiate the reforms that it afterwards accepts and proves that we don't need anything more. This is one of the things that I think ought to be remembered in this connection. 2 minutes and all I want to say, and it can't be done adequately. I do want, though, to hit this notion of human nature being the only thing at fault. I respectfully suggest the senator doesn't mean it. It makes a lot of difference under what system you live. No goodness of human nature could make slavery decent unless human nature rejected slavery. And that is true of some forms of wage slavery as well as of chattel slavery in the world. No goodness of a monarch can make to us who love our form of government can make monarchy acceptable. And human nature is itself affected by the situation into which you are born and within which you have to act. And that's why I want the senator to tell us far more specifically what he's going to do on some of these great issues. Are the military to get the money? And is there anything more centralized than a military industrial complex, to quote Eisenhower, one of the most discerning remarks he or anybody else ever made? Is that the way we keep freedom, the military industrial complex? Again, that is not so much the product of wicked men, good men are in it. It's the product of the situation that we have to tackle in this world. And that's my emphasis, and I am very glad to come to urge you as individuals, as men and women, to take your part. It's you who've got to control whether it's a central government or a local government better than we have controlled it. And I find myself pleased at the interest of students. Yes, in conservatism, it's better than the old apathy. And I am very pleased to find that there is a plan here, for instance, for people to express their opinions peacefully in the interest of peace. I was handed a notice that there is to be a Tucson peace walk next Saturday, beginning at 9:30. That there's to be a rally at 4 p.m. at the Armory Park. I'm not making a full announcement of this, but I'm congratulating this city on having young people who care and who show that they care by personal action of nonviolent sort. And this I want all of us to do in our votes, in our talking to our friends. We don't need to save America by copying the worst aspects of communism or fascism, by turning ourselves into spies and denouncers of our neighbors, by becoming suspicious in the most fantastic ways. Good people are hit by the disease. It's for us to help to cure them in the conservatism of those who believe that democracy can be made to work.
And our final refutation from Senator Goldwater.
Again, 10 minutes to answer the multitude of questions that Mr. Thomas has put to me is a very short time. I might suggest that if he does have my book, The Conscience of a Conservative, and hasn't read it, that in it he can find most of these answers. Now, I about the income tax, and I'll try to cover three, Mr. Thomas, but I think that's all the time I have, and because you probably haven't gone through the book and you haven't been in Tucson long enough to understand the philosophy that I have out here, I'll give you the benefit of the short time I have. Now, the income tax, in my estimation, was the device by which we have spent ourselves into a lot of the domestic trouble that we have today. I am not naive enough, though, to say that we can do away with the income tax tomorrow. If we do, we have to replace it with something. It would probably be in the form of a more unfavorable tax than the one we have today. The income tax is a tax of great inequity. Over 80% of the taxes come from the so-called working class. This isn't what we call equitable taxation. The graduated income tax is a tax upon initiative and success, certainly not in keeping with the American idea. But the peculiar thing about taxes is this, that no matter how we spend our tax money, in the last nearly 30 years, we never seem to solve the problems that Mr. Thomas is concerned about. I remember the speech about one-third of the nation that Franklin Roosevelt made, and I've watched the efforts in Congress since I've been there to alleviate the problems of some of the people in this country. We have, according to the census and according to Mr. Thomas, 31 million people today in this country who live substandardly. Yes, we conservatives are concerned about that. We're concerned that in nearly 30 years of the so-called liberal or socialist application, they haven't done anything about it. I recall that the campaign brought out that 17 million people went to bed hungry every night. Now, whether this was a figment of the Harvard mind or not, I don't know. But nevertheless, it was made. And my argument is this, that if in nearly 30 years of this kind of effort, where we've seen welfare costs go up by some 300%, where we've seen, even though we've been in a good period of prosperity for the last 20 years, we still see costs of welfare and relief mounting. Now, if it hasn't been solved under the socialist or the liberal approach, then I think it's time that Americans allow conservatism an opportunity to show them how we can alleviate the sufferings of the people and raise their living standards. Now, the minimum wage. This is something I know a little bit about. I've been in business in my life, and I've met payrolls, and I'm happy to say that my payrolls are consistently above anything that the federal government has ever suggested. But this is what the planners don't realize. If you set a minimum wage, it's only a matter of a year or 2 years before that becomes the starvation wage. I remember when the totally inadequate wage of 35 cents an hour was proposed. It wasn't long before that was a starvation wage. We now have a dollar, and it's going up to eventually a dollar and a quarter in the next few years. This will become the bottom of the totem pole. Now, you're not helping the worker when you give him an unearned wage increase, but because the costs have to be absorbed in the final price. The socialist planners would find this even if government were running the business of this country, that you can't just willy-nilly decide that a man is going to be paid this much an hour when possibly he doesn't earn it, or possibly he earns more. The thing is that minimum wage, and why I resist the federal government establishing them, is that they have never proven to be of value in raising the living standard of the American people. You might say that gold is the sweat of the worker. Money is the sweat of the worker. Property is the sweat of the worker. When the worker sweats harder, he gets more of each. And this is when minimum wages, the problem of creating a minimum wage by federal edict disappears. And wherever this is allowed to operate, there is no trouble involved. On war, I am just as totally against war as Mr. Thomas or any liberal or socialist in this country. I don't want to think of the day coming when my children or my grandchildren have to go to war. But I'm not afraid of war. And I don't think the average American is. Neither is the average American advocating war. But the average American is a very realistic person. He knows, as I know and conservatives know, that as much as we'd like to believe that by disarming, by abandoning nuclear tests, Khrushchev might change his mind and become a nice boy overnight, it isn't going to happen. History shows us that. I think the day's coming. I think it's a long ways off. We don't even measure the same in this world. I just got back from England, and they don't even make change the same way. And that's mighty confusing. We go so many kilometers an hour in France and so many miles an hour in the United States. Now, if we can't agree on these fundamental, simple things, how are we going to agree on the vast problems that are created by the differences in approach to religion, by the differences in approach to government? This is the reason, Mr. Thomas, that I say and feel deeply that man is our continuing problem, not conditions. Man creates the crises. Conditions do not. And only man can remove them. I agree with you, sir, that a bomb or bombs or bullets will not stop communism any more than the similar weapons of war will stop the idea of the American Republic, our ideals of freedom. Nero wasn't able to stamp out Christianity. There will always be one or two left, no matter what kind of a weapon we use. Now, the best weapon we have is one that we haven't been using too well. And I'm not too proud of my country when I realize that we are the greatest salesman in the world, but we haven't been able to sell our product. The product is the concern about freedom and the concern about making the people of the world free. You make men free, and they're going to take care of their stomachs, and they're going to take care of their clothing. But if you don't, if you allow them to live in slavery, then we're never going to help them. I think when the day comes that America makes up its mind to a man, to a person, that we are going to live under the concepts of our Constitution and our Declaration of Independence, which recognizes us as being endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, when we recognize that we have a responsibility to that Creator to live as if we believe these freedoms came from Him, we're going to become such a beacon light in this world that the whole world is going to want to be like the United States, not be like communism, to which one-third of the people of this world have been attracted since World War II. I believe that the American system is the greatest system ever devised by man. Its governmental system, its economic system. It has created more freedom. It has given more to more people. Why do people want to come to this country if we're in such bad shape? We can't begin to handle the millions of immigrants who want to come here. My concern as a conservative is that we are slowly but surely destroying the very attractiveness of our government and our economic system by restraining people in their free actions, by concentrating government more and more in one central point in this country, in Washington, by denying ultimately to the farmer his choice of planting, his choice of price, by denying to the retailer his choice of price, his choice of location. And mind you, this has to come if we're going to dabble with central control or central planning. Now, Mr. Thomas, if I haven't made myself abundantly clear here, then I know I haven't had a chance to cover all of the things that you've raised. Lord, that would take me the rest of the night. I do know that people here have questions, and possibly in the questions, we will touch on some of the things that are still of concern to you. Thank you.